Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz, editor-in-chief of the Science of Psychotherapy magazine, and I'm here with managing editor Richard Hill. Hi, Richard.
Hi, I'm Matt. Fantastic to see you. Are you still in? I'm still in.
We're still in, yes. We're not going out much these days.
But doing very well. We went for a walk the other day and there were so many people that we actually felt a bit uncomfortable and came home. But it's been, we're still getting on. There's lots to do. The magazine will be out in a few weeks, so that's keeping me busy, and we've got a few other projects. So it's not as though we're sitting around like some people seem to have nothing else to do. But
No, it's been very busy my end as well.
We've got someone today. We've got someone from Australia who should be a much better friend. So we're starting that relationship now.
We are, absolutely. So we're going to go across to Perth, the other side of the country, and we're talking to psychologist Daryl Chow, and he is a very, very clever guy. Not intimidatingly clever, because he's such a nice guy,
he's really impressed me, absolutely.
Yeah, he's a very, very clever fellow. And when he did his PhD, he studied in the area of development and the practice of highly effective psychotherapists. And his mentor was Scott Miller, who we had on the show just a few weeks ago. And they've been working together. They've been collaborating together. So Daryl is one of the co-authors of this new book that we've talked about, Better Results Using Deliberate Practice to Improve Therapeutic Effectiveness.
Yeah, so with Scott Miller and Mark Hubble, it's just a fabulous continuation and bringing together the work they've been doing over the past few years. And so I'm wondering what Daryl has to say about that. He's written a few books himself, so we want to talk about those. Uh-huh. And we want to see what's happening over in Western Australia.
Absolutely. All right, so let's go across and say hi to Daryl.
So welcome, Daryl Chow. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, it's great connecting with both of you from the other side of Australia.
Yes. Hi, Daryl. Matthew here from Brisbane.
Hey,
good to have you.
So, Daryl, you're someone that I've had my eye on to bring on the show for ages, because partly because of the work you do, and also partly because you're Australian, so that makes us feel great. And the work you do with Scott Miller, but we noticed the book coming out, so we jumped on and grabbed Scott. And it was just natural to have you on as soon as possible afterwards. So here we've got you. We want to talk a little bit, but maybe just a little bit of a quick insight into a little bit of you, and then also the way you engaged with Scott so wonderfully.
So, well, you know, Scott and I, we began this kind of relationship like pen pals. Like, you know, I first got to know him and Mark Hubble, our other co-author, in a library in Queensland when I was as undergrad then. That was like 2003, 2004. And I just stumbled across some of their books, like The Impossible Cases, Heroic Klein, Escape from Babel. And I was sort of taken aback, like, wow, you know, this makes a lot of sense. There's a lot to learn from. And as time went on, there was an email listserv, and, you know, we connected. And I, at that time, I was also writing out to people that I read about, right? So I just sent them emails and to tell them I really appreciate what they did and I got some questions. Most of the time, people didn't reply. Scott was one of the few that replied. And I thought, this guy replies. It's kind of interesting, you know? And we kept up the conversation and years went by. And, you know, when they started talking a little bit more about interest in looking at people who were highly effective compared to average practitioners, I was really interested as well. And that sort of led me back out of the woods of clinical practice where I was from in Singapore. And I decided to pursue further research in that, got to a doctoral program to do a bit more research in Perth. And our relationship kept up. And every year now, I'll make a pilgrimage to Chicago to run the intensive workshop for deliberate practice.
That's beautiful. I mean, it was very much like that with me and Ernie Rossi. And I just hang on, and I've been making the pilgrimage over there for nearly 15 years now. So you're just a babe in the pilgrimage. But it was it was a PhD. I was just wondering, I was just trying to remind myself, was PhD or postgrad? But it was a PhD that then brought you in. So what was the topic of that?
So, you know, I've been working for a while, and in Singapore, I've been practicing as a psychologist with my master's, but then I decided to go back to do this and did a 3-4 year long meditation on this topic about the development and practices of highly effective therapists. Mm. So what we really wanted to know was not so much as what we knew in the research at that time was people were examining nominated master therapists compared to people on the ground level who were really reaping reliable results client after client. So it's not that they were nominated by their peers, and neither was it because of their good results with a few clients. This was based on a reliable data that they have collected, and we wanted to examine what makes the best stand out from the rest. So we sort of looked through the lens from the expert of expertise, which is Kay-Anders Erickson, on how he examined expert development in other domains like music, where we three have an affinity on, business, surgeons, and so on, and sort of transpose that into therapy to see if we could find anything.
Yeah, it was really interesting, you know, when Scott did a slide of this and showed the incremental improvement that occurred in all these different type of professional practices and in sports and in various ways. But then he brought up the slide of saying, now let's look at what's happening in therapy, and there actually wasn't any particular improvement of the industry as a whole, and there were very interesting results of individual therapists in the mix. Now, was that something that you found in your work independently, or did you sort of were you working with Scott together?
That's right. So Scott was thankfully serving as a consultant, as an external personnel to help me out in this. So I'm really grateful for that. He's been a lifelong mentor and collaborator now, and our listeners will also want to hear the other episode with him that you guys had. But briefly, what we found was similar, which was that experience did not account for the differences in outcomes, in client outcomes. So it's as if, like, you know, practitioners have been, let's say they say they have 20 years of experience, it actually sounds more like 1 year of experience repeated 19 more times. Because the same sort of results were being harnessed across the years. But confidence incrementally goes through this valley of doubt initially when they graduate, but then it sort of goes up. Yet confidence and competence are conflated in this sort of instance.
So what are the some of the variables that you found were the hallmarks of effective therapy?
So let's just make it clear that what we didn't find were things like profession, what's your qualification, how many years of experience you had. These things didn't make a difference at all when we analyzed them on what we call multi-level modeling. It didn't turn out to be anything predictive of reliable outcomes. What we found were a couple of things. One is the amount of time a practitioner invests in actually targeted practice or what in this case, in this initial study, was to look at how much time they devote to individual, solitary, deliberate practice targeted at their work. Mm-hmm. One time when we presented this finding, we were trying to get to talk about various nuance of what people were doing. And before we could get to that, somebody in Amsterdam shouted out in the crowd and said, "Can you just tell us what to work on?" You know, like, and that's the key, isn't it? Because our field has been so enamored with the how-tos that we forget to think that we need to figure out your what before the how, right? Yeah. And Scott talked about this in the other podcast episode you had about leverage, because each of us have different growth edge. We need to figure out what yours, what's mine, based on our existing outcomes as opposed to say that everybody needs to do A, B, C, or D. Another thing we found, I think, might be of interest as well, we didn't publish this other piece of results, but it was in the dissertation, was that we asked practitioners, how many times were you surprised by the client feedback that you've gotten, right, out of your typical clinical practice week? And it turns out that the more effective practitioners reported being more surprised by the feedback that they got. And if you stop to think about this, this sort of is a little bit counterintuitive, because you would think that the expert would kind of, yeah, I know this stuff. I know what to do. I have a very clear roadmap of what's ahead. But according to a theory by Janet Matclough, and she talks about this idea of hyper-correction, that somehow a person with more deep domain knowledge and is reliably reaping better outcomes is more ready to correct, to hyper-correct what they thought, and then re-update what they know in the moment in that adaptable kind of way. A bit like what you might think about Milton Erickson, always utilizing what the client brings in therapy, as opposed to like, this is the way and I knew it all along kind of thing.
Yeah, that adaptability and flexibility would be highly correlated with creativity, I would imagine.
Sure. I would argue so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is why we talk, you know, the art of psychotherapy. Mm. Of course, in some minds, where as soon as you start talking about the art of something, that diminishes its relevance on a scientific level, which is another argument that will continue on for some years. But this wonderful idea that when you come out of a performance, when you come out of an expression, a session, and you think, oh gosh, I don't think I did terribly well, that you can get these surprising results from clients saying, oh, that was the best session I ever had. And this is actually, this goes through a lot of from people who are who improvise, who utilize their talents in a sort of an improvised way rather than a pre-planned way. And we hear this with performers, and the idea. My wife says it as a massage therapist, and one of the thoughts that I've had and others have expressed as well, that I share, is that when it becomes unpredictable, when you lose that comfort zone of predictability, then it's exactly as you say: you work harder, and so you become less observant, less able to directly observe. To adjudicate your own quality, and you're just really in the moment. But that's when it's really necessary to get the client's feedback. This is why client's feedback is so important. Whereas when you're relaxed and doing the same old thing, you think, hey, I'm doing really well. So this led you to this really important thing of what the client tells you is incredibly important, which you call feedback-informed therapy.
Yeah, so that's where, you know, guided by Scott Miller and the team at the International Center for Clinical Excellence, or ICCE, has been talking a lot about the importance of using measures not just as an assessment tool, but using as a conversational tool. Because what you want from the feedback is not like what we traditionally, you know, I know I was taught that way as a psychologist, that when you do an assessment, is that you want to take some information and then use that to guide your thinking, and that's it. But instead, what you want to do is take the feedback to feed it forward and to have a cool discussion, a collaboration, a co-creation of what's to happen. And it's quite different from just using measures as an evaluation. Now, often we get people would say that, you know, but we do ask for feedback, right? And I think that's true. We do ask for feedback with or without some kind of formal measure. But I think the key here is the surgeon Atul Gawande, he wrote a really brilliant book. In fact, a couple of brilliant books. One was Checklist Manifesto. The second was Better, about his training trying to become a better surgeon and how he enlisted a coach. And his last book about palliative care and about end of life, he talks about, what's that called? On Being Mortal, I think that's the book title. But he talks about, in Checklist Manifesto, the importance of understanding not so much as human ignorance, but human fallibility. The fact that we've got so many various variables, so much complexities to deal with at hand, sometimes things fall off the crack. And which is why we need to think like pilots with a kind of pre-flight checklist. And he started this idea in 2009 with a very small budget. And he went to WHO to say that, look, I want to investigate if we can actually cut the infection rates and the mortality rates for people who go to hospital for treatment, that people actually get sick from being in the hospital, right? Instead of getting the cure or the managed care that they need. So they created this checklist. They went to four hospitals, two were from developed countries and two were from developing countries. And what they found was that it shaved infection rates by half and mortality close to half.
Wow.
But the kicker is that when they asked the hospitals, what do you think? Majority of them just went, it's just another thing that we need to do. And then when he showed them the results, they were floored. They were like, you mean just making sure that we are tuned that way? And I think that's really interesting because, you know, you talk about art and science earlier. To me, this kind of bifurcation or classification is what universities do. They classify in faculties. But in real life, art and science, there's science and art, and there's art and science, right? And here, when we talk about clinical measures, we also need to weave the clinical quantified measures with the intuition that you talk a lot about in the mirroring hands type of work. You want both to come to this marriage, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly think this is why I talk in the Mirroring Hands book about self-organizing systems and complex systems, that actually art is not so much something weird and that only strange people with, you know, hugging trees and with feathers in their hair, but it's actually the non-conscious process of emergence that people don't know where it comes from, and so they think, oh, this must be art. But actually, there's nothing more mathematically scientific than complexity ideas in the way these things. So it's
now, Richard and Matt, can I jump in to just say something to pick up a real key thing you kind of hinted at? And you used the word improvise early on, right? I think the craft of improvisation, be it in acting or in music or in the craft of therapy, is so critical.
Yeah.
But when we say, you know, when we go in and we just do our thing and we adapt, I think that is necessary but insufficient. Because, you know, when we talk about, when we study improvisation, chance happens to the prepared mind. There are basic concepts that you need to have a handle on to be able to open yourself up in that mode, right? But when you're off stage, that's when a lot of deliberation, very focused and deep kind of learning happens. Then when you go back on stage, you open, you rent yourself out, and you sort of adapt, flexible, weave, or what Ben Stiles, the psychological researcher, says about being responsive.
Oh, no, absolutely. I have often said this when people talk about, oh, so that means I don't have to learn anything. I can just improvise. And I said, well, taking it back to music, and the great jazz pianists, the great jazz improvisers, they'll sit there and tell you the different scales, the different technical things they learned. And but a really good example is a friend of mine who was one of the best Australian jazz guitarists. He went to New York. He was there, met a few people, was invited to sit in on a band and to play. And he went and he played and he improvised and everybody did what he did. And he went home and he didn't move out of his bedroom for 6 months. He said, I was so untechnically prepared for the quality of work. And it was about the improvisation. So that's the sort of thing that using that story from music is that a lot of therapists are not technically prepared. And so we're very much in favor of learn a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's similar in composition. So if we talk about film composition, you have to have a whole lot of so-called chops. You know, the techniques. You have to know what the techniques are that you can draw on in the moment. So you have a scene, and you have an idea in your head of what should accompany that scene, and you don't then have to go. You don't go and then learn different styles of music to fit that. You already have those in you, and you just pull out what you need.
Well, can I then ask both of you a question about this? You know, if you, you know, if you think about, you know, you guys have got acting and music background, and we think about our field in psychotherapy, why do you think that's the case that we have not yet moved the needle? Like, you know, what's something that we can graft from that kind of learning into our field?
Firstly, I think it's because we've come out of the medical model and not out of an arts background. So that's probably, you know, part of the answer. We're sort of transitioning out of a particular kind of model, which is very much, you know, you learn a protocol and you execute that protocol to fix somebody. Whereas, you know, we're just talking about film composition. Mm-hmm. You don't, you know, there's no one protocol for a love scene, and you apply that protocol and you've fixed the scene.
It's a really interesting question. I mean, besides that answer, there's two other things that I think of. One is permissions. What our culture and our area of our field of work is permission to, and there's not very much permission given to expansiveness. There's a lot of permission given to reproducing what you know.
Why is that? Why do you think that's the case in our field?
That's the second thing. Is I can crassly put it as marketing. That actually people spend a lot of time studying stuff and researching it and producing a protocol and a method and putting together a course. And it's kind of like I can't be encouraging you to go off and do all these other things and varying and not following me and not finding. Matt, so that becomes problematic. I don't think there's an intention in the marketing. My issue is that the center of all therapy, the source of all therapeutic knowledge is human beings. We've been doing CBT and we've been doing feedback informed therapy. We've been doing all these things for hundreds of years. You can read it in Shakespeare. But what we've done lately in the last couple of hundred years is this medical model, siloing down into specific elements, and kind of we study something, put our name to it, and then charge people $20 to use it and discourage people from using somebody else's.
Right.
There's a bit of an answer, but it's much more complex than that. We can't cover it all in this thing, but isn't that an interesting topic?
Yeah. Just quickly, another motivation for protocols is it's supposed to make it safe, right? Hmm. So we can't let someone loose on another person without you having the boundaries of protocol, so we know that they're not going to do any damage.
So yeah. linear thinking systems.
Yes.
Yeah. But moving on linear things, let's get back to Daryl. We don't often get a chance to answer questions, although I talk a lot. But I want to get back to your stuff, because there's a couple of books I know we've talked and we'll talk a bit more about the one that you've just done with Scott. But your first one, The First Kiss, is one of the ones. It's just terrific. Can you tell us a bit about that? It's about the nature of the way therapists engage.
You know, I just got a message a couple of days ago. Somebody sent me and say that, love your work, but your book sort of just gave me a feeling like the title of the book sounds like a romantic thing, you know, The First Kiss. And unfortunately, it's not a romance novel. The idea behind the book is really about undoing our traditional way of thinking about first sessions and reigniting what it means to engage another human being, especially in a very vulnerable moment, which is at the beginning. This all started because there's two things. One was that when I started consulting with agencies and individuals, I, you know, often when I'm doing consults, coaching, supervision, I would make sure that I have a look at the graphs, the data, and want to see where they're at. And one time, one agency started to send me their results, and I pulled out all the files. I just looked at it And then I was kind of shocked that on one hand, I wasn't shocked that the average number of sessions that typically people come for was about 4 to 6 sessions. Now, that I know from international benchmark is common, that on average, brief or meant to be long-term therapy, people come for an average about 4 to 6 visits. But what really kind of took me by surprise some years back was that when I look at the modal number of sessions, which is the largest frequency of people who that people actually come for X number of sessions, turns out to be 1.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is different from like Michael Hoyt, who was in your podcast, that he talks a lot about the importance of creating single sessions type of treatment. This is not about that. There's value in that for certain settings. But this is from data where people planned to take the step forward and seek help because they were in distress and relational problems or having mood issues. And then after that, they backed off. They stopped coming for whatever reason. Now, of course, you can say they got what they came for, but I don't know if that's too quick to let ourselves out of the hook, given that people are likely to reap more benefit if you continue to see them, right? That is, if there's a good fit and there's a right direction of where it's going. So at first, I thought this was an outlier, and then the more I saw the data, the more I was becoming less and less surprised. And then I went back to the research. I looked at a couple of ones, and it turns out that on average, people, 20 to 30% of people come for one session only, and they have an unplanned cancellation after that. And to me, that's very depressing. I mean, if you think about this, right, if you're a client, you are facing tumultuous times in your life, and you decided to take that step. In this case, in Australia, you need to go and see a GP, you get a referral, and then you come to see a psychologist. You know, the amount of anxiety that's stirring up, and then you see this person for 60 minutes or so, and then after that you go, maybe not. You know, one time when I was in a cafe writing this book, I had this guy with his father-in-law, you know, just on the next table, and I sort of heard him talking and telling his father-in-law this. He said, the father-in-law asked him, "So how did it go?" And then the son-in-law said, "You mean the session, the therapy?" Yeah. How did it go? He said, "Oh, all I did was I spent the 15 minutes answering questions, and the guy gets paid for doing that."
Yeah. We've heard that a lot, haven't we?
Yeah.
And these styles, I mean, certainly the term that we use, Ernie and I, is client responsiveness, and this shifting of the focus from the therapist being the instigator of the progress to handing it over, as Erickson said, to, you know, hand the responsibility back to the client. And it was very interesting. Michael Hoyt, again, my good friend Michael, he found a demonstration I did most interesting, because he said you spend about 3 or 4 minutes in the beginning of the session just making sure everyone was sitting exactly where the client wanted them to sit. Beautiful. He said, I've never done that. He said, I'd have my chair, they'd have the couch, and that was it. And so suddenly he's saying, God, I've been doing this for 30 years, and I'd never thought to ask them where they wanted to sit. So really interesting. Beautiful. Little elements. And these are the sorts of things you talk about in the book. Does the book give a sort of a set of ideas and options and possibilities that they can utilize in establishing this very non-romantic but sensitive vulnerable relationship?
Well, I mean, the central thesis, the central idea of the book is that we should focus less about what we're taking from an intake perspective or doing a clinical thorough assessment. Instead, we should be focusing about more of what we are giving from the client's perspective. So we really need more outrospection than introspection from the get-go. And you know, in that book, they are littered with a couple of ideas of ways of thinking about that and how to, I think fundamentally is to first and foremost undo this whole needing to get a clinical thorough assessment first. And then there are a couple of ideas.
Now, sometimes that's a cultural change, isn't it? Because sometimes it's not up to the individual practitioner. Sometimes there's an agency that, you know, there's a requirement to do a lot of this. And
I think there's an assumption that that's the requirement, that we need to begin to stand up and maybe even subvert these notions, because this has a risk of not benefiting the people who need the service. And we need to be subversive of those things that sort of gets in the way of treatment. So for example, even like getting somebody to do a intake first, right? And then after they farm them out after the triage to a treating therapist, you know, that idea too, we need to kind of rethink that very carefully, because from our view, from a hierarchical bureaucratic agency system, that makes perfect sense. Because you get them in, you triage, you pull them in, and then you sort them out a bit like a medical model. But if you see it from the client's perspective, what I'm telling you, Matt, something, and then after that, I'm going to a new person to see Richard after that, and yeah, they're going to pass information, but wait a second. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, the humanity of that sort of gets lost in that kind of system.
Exactly. And I've had clients, you know, say to me, well, you know, I've been to, you know, this number of, you know, psychologists, but I spent three sessions just answering questions and filling out forms. And
yeah, it's very curious. I just remind, it's a bit of a silly thing, but it's worth just sort of stirring everybody. The client that I walk in knocked on my door, literally walked into the clinic and knocked on my door and said to me, I'm going to see another psychiatrist. And I've seen everybody. I've read everything. There's actually nothing you can tell me. There's no one who can tell me anything. But brain training, that's interesting. I can come back in about an hour and I'll give you 60 minutes. and it was this sort of thing that, so I didn't actually investigate. I didn't ask her anything. I mean, the last thing she wanted to do, she didn't want me to ask her anything. She didn't want me to tell her anything. We ended up having a really good session because of various other reasons, that are very much based around what you're talking about. But the beauty of what you're talking about is it's not just Daryl's nice idea. You guys have got a lot of research and investigation and supportive frameworks that give it the basis. This is what has been your big goal, hasn't it? Not just to, because there's lots of people who have these nice ideas, but that it's finding that it's supported and also expanded. As you say, when you found this one session thing, you say, okay, I've got to think about this again, deliberate practice. I've got to think about this a bit more deeply. So is that that was a real goal, a real part of the way you wanted to do things?
Well, I would say that's the case after the fact. You know, like most scientific discoveries, things are discovered and we explain them after the fact. So, you know, I think with the way we are taught about scientific discovery is so linear, like first you have a theory, you develop a hypothesis, and then you test out the idea. But in reality, according to someone like Peter Medawar, who talks about actual scientific discovery, it's messy. It's like the creative endeavor. And then we sort of make stuff up after the fact, and we just kind of like theorize it from that. You know, and so much of the masters that we learn, you know, they test things out, they try things out, then they develop some kind of notions and mental representations and models about that after the fact. But, you know, for me, I think one real source of inspiration, and I didn't know this until much later, was actually Carl Rogers. You know, we all know him as the father of person-centered therapy, a Rogerian. It's funny, he said that he's not a Rogerian. But, you know, and one thing I didn't know was how doggedly committed he was into the empirical side of things, and how he hired even behavioral therapists to come in the room or watch video recordings, quote them, understand what was happening. And you know, he sort of deconstructed things, you know, he flipped things around and was willing to do all of that kind of work. He was even cited to be one of the first few to start using Flume, you know, in those days, to kind of Flume therapy to analyze that. And you know, if you dig a little bit further, you see the amount of research he does and stuff that were not successful as well, you know, real, real inspiration.
Sorry, no, Matt, you go. Yeah.
Oh, I was just conscious of the time. And
we're getting, I think we've been going on. It's just fascinating stuff, Daryl. It's fantastic.
Now, I know we talked before we started recording about some other topics that we haven't got a chance to touch on today. So I am hoping that we'll be able to get you back and continue the conversation.
Sure thing.
But for today, is there something that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, you know, May 26th comes the release of the book Better Results, Using Deliberate Practice to Get Better Therapeutic Outcomes or Improving Our Therapeutic Effectiveness. So that's written with Scott Miller and Mark Howell, two of my heroes. So, you know, I'm like a bar musician playing with you two in this kind of context, and you know, I'm really thankful and grateful for the couple of years writing this with them. We nearly tore each other's heads apart doing this. We're glad that we've come to the stage now. So that's going to be released. If people want to know more, there is the betterresultsbook.com about that. There's going to be a free companion workbook that we're going to release with that. And if people want to know more about what we're thinking, where the edge of our own frontiers, you can come to darrowchow.com/frontiers, where every other week we talk about ideas of how to become a better therapist. And also we have a not so frequent podcast related to that.
And there's some other great stuff, and we'll put all these on our on the web page. I mean, there's the Facebook group, which is really terrific. There's a bunch of great ways to connect with you or the work you're doing, the sort of stuff with Scott. And again, we'll be giving this book a great plug, because it's really, well, Matt and I think it's really important. This is the next important step in making us better practitioners.
Yep, thank you. And thank you for asking great questions.
Okay. Thanks, Daryl, so much for being here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. It's been such a pleasure having you.
Thanks.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Wow, Richard, I felt like I cut the conversation off a bit short there, but we were sort of running out of time. But I am hoping that we can get Daryl back and continue the conversation in the not too distant future.
Yeah, no, I think it was pretty good, Matt. Although I must say, if we needed to move on in subjects, and so stopping it there. But I sort of was suggesting to Daryl after the call that we might maybe back it towards the middle latter part of May, just near when the book comes out, and we can follow through. I mean, one of my favorite things of his is, what is the value of a bad session? Really interesting stuff. He's written some interesting articles, which you can already check into when you go to his website, which I'm figuring you're going to have on the show notes.
Absolutely. So he's got a very comprehensive website. We'll give you that link in the show notes and on the landing page for this podcast. So please go and check him out. He's got blogs and videos and courses and a whole stack of stuff there. He's a very clever fellow. You'll be doing yourself a favor if you get to know Daryl.
Well, here we are. We've been swapping roles of who starts and who stops. So now I have to say, well, thanks very much, everyone, for being on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. That's all for this week, and we look forward to seeing you next week. So bye-bye, Matt.
Okay, see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.